From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. This week, we're going back to school and talking with professors from around the university about their work. The university's iconic columns make a pretty picture, but they also hold clues about what Missouri was like when parts of the state were underwater. Paleobiology professor John Huntley tells us about how shells are a window to the distant past. My coworkers always make fun of me for starting with basic questions, but what is paleobiology?
Well, it's one of the it's essentially paleontology. So we study the history of life. And historically, a lot of invertebrate paleontologists had worked in very applied settings for specific or geological purposes. And in the 70s and 80s, there was this thing called the paleobiological revolution, where there was much more of a focus on the biological aspect of it and trying to understand the evolutionary process through time and the ecological context, and having a better understanding of the history of life in terms of testing bigger picture evolutionary questions. So, but it's just sort of a newer term for paleontology.
So when we talk about an invertebrate, we're talking about something without a spine.
Correct. Yeah. So animals without a spine, animals without a backbone or a notochord. Yeah, sure.
And what are some invertebrates that we may know of or encounter in our regular lives?
So I mostly work with seashells. So bivalves, clams, oysters, scallops, and their relatives, which are mollusks in the same group as snails and cephalopods, squids, that sort of thing. Other invertebrates would be any type of arthropod, an insect, or spiders, that sort of thing.
And how do you go about studying these animals that lived in the distant past? Do you go are you out there digging up old riverbeds or seabeds?
Sure, yeah. So most of the work I do is with animals that lived in the ocean. And so locally, we have a lot of rocks that were deposited in the ocean hundreds of millions of years ago. And so we've done some work in southeast Missouri, but most of my work is focused on much geologically younger samples, just from the last million or so years. And most of that work is done in Italy. Mm-hmm. So in that case, we're looking in core samples. So we drill – well, we don't. Other folks have drilled and collected core samples, and then we analyze what comes up out of the ground, looking at older layers.
You also study these things from the Paleoprotozoic period to the Anthropocene. That's probably a huge period of time. What was going on during those times? Were dinosaurs roaming the earth?
Yeah, that's sort of a a tongue-in-cheek statement, because it encompasses the entire history of of life that's more complex than bacteria, right? Uh-huh. So it's sort of a broad-scale approach. So I've in looking at those earlier episodes in the history of life, that was looking at the morphological disparity questions. And it's understanding the evolution of complexity of shape, of body shape and form, and how that has changed and why. Because in some of the earliest evidence of life, what we're looking at are simple single-celled organisms. And counting the number of species can be rather difficult, because a lot of the identifying traits are gone because they're preserved as fossils, and there's only a cell. So you only have, a single cell to go by.
Can you really see a fossil of one cell?
You can. You
wow.
can. Yeah, it is incredible. So instead of looking at how biodiversity changed through time in terms of counts of species, we look at how the complexity of shape changed and trying to understand what that meant for how these organisms interacted with their environment and with one another. Yes, sort of understanding the bigger picture trends of complexity and body size.
And are there thoughts on why certain periods would have seen more rapid evolution or more rapid development?
Yeah, so these are obviously complex questions. So in some cases, it seems to be a time where there may be more nutrients that are available. So, yeah, so it could be sort of a big influx of nutrients into these ecosystems. In one case, we happen to see a big escalation of prey and their anti-predator defenses happening at the same time that we're first forests are first developing on continents. And so as plants cover the continents, they help produce deeper weathering on the soils, and you have a fundamentally different way of weathering sediments, which then get washed down into the rivers. And so there has been the thought that perhaps because you have forests developing on land, you're extracting more nutrients because you have deeper chemical weathering, and then those get flushed into the ocean, which provide a broader base for the ecosystems in the ocean. So coupled with increased dangers from predators, then the prey responded. So a lot of the questions we look at is, are these trends because of top-down pressures from predators or bottom-up opportunities from nutrients in the base of the food web changing?
And maybe the answer is both.
Yes, I think so. I think so. Yeah, I think it can be case specific, right? So, yeah, and it just sort of goes to further highlight the complexity of these systems. And again, context is important to understand.
And if I were walking along the seashore at a point in time, like when Tyrannosaurus Rex lived, mm-hmm. which is a point in time that I'm not really sure when it was. It was just a really long time ago. Would the shells that are washing up on the shore be visibly different from the shells I would see today somewhere?
I think so. It's sure. So the Tyrannosaurus Rex was around in the latest Cretaceous. And so at that point, North America looked very different. There was a large inland sea that essentially connected at some point from the Gulf of Mexico up to the Arctic Ocean.
So Missouri was underwater.
We were close to shore. Parts of Missouri would have been underwater. So sure, at that time, there would have been pretty different groups of seashells. Some of them would have been familiar and some of them perhaps not familiar at all. So sure, yeah, there's been...
Were they really big or really small?
So in this Cretaceous interior seaway, there were these bivalves that were some of the largest to have ever lived that were a meter or more. So, you know, 2-3 feet across, very large shells, very thin shells oftentimes, and living in the deeper waters of this inland sea. So those may not have been washing up on shore quite as much. But sure, yeah, some of them were quite large and others not so much. There were also other groups of clams living at this time that actually formed reefs. So there was a time in the late Cretaceous where corals weren't primary reef builders, but these really strange clams that built these big reef-like structures. And you can see these in some of the more tropical locales in the world.
What are the implications for this sort of in our modern time? So you're looking at something that seems so simple, shells, but it's actually the early evolution of life as we know it over an incredibly long period of time.
So the current environment is changing fairly drastically in a variety of ways. The world is warming. Sea levels are rising. Humans are, of course, a lot of our activities are polluting waterways and flushing lots of nutrients into waterways. So we're fundamentally changing a lot of ecosystems. And there's this new effort called conservation paleobiology that's very much directed at understanding what the world was like prior to such extensive human influence, to understand, okay, this is a good background, this is a good baseline for what environments were like in a location, and perhaps these can be targets for the restoration of ecosystems.
So for just the, you know, random Missourian who goes around looking at rocks and outcroppings, I mean, Missouri has quite a varied topography, but are there any things that people might be able to see in their regular lives that relate to your research?
Sure. Especially in mid-Missouri, we have an abundance of limestone. And in many of these groups, especially in a group called the Burlington Limestone, they're just most of the rock itself is actually made out of fragments of fossils. And so you can see this if you go to the columns on campus. The columns are made up of almost nothing but fossils of dead marine organisms. And they reflect a very different time in Missouri's history when there was a shallow tropical sea covering most of Missouri. And there were very different animals than what we're used to that dominated the sea floor. And so this is one of the things I'm excited to start a new project. I received a grant from the National Science Foundation to, in terms of research, I'm working on the parasites in Italy and China. But the outreach education portion of this is developing a new curriculum called Geology of the Columns here at Mizzou.
That's interesting. And the National Science Foundation is a big deal to get a grant from.
Yes, I was very grateful for that. That was a fortunate event for sure. So, and I should give proper credit. I was able to secure that grant. Part of that was acquiring a lot of pilot data and demonstrating the feasibility. And since being here at the university, I've received a lot of support from both the department and the College of Arts and Sciences and providing opportunities for me to travel abroad, collect these data, and make a compelling argument to NSF to send us some money to keep this project going. So I've been pretty fortunate since being here. So with this course, I'm going to develop what's known as a themes course. It's a 1-hour credit in geology, so students can come in and take it. It's a 5-week class, and we will use the columns here on campus as a means to understand deep time, how the environment has changed through time, how organisms have changed through time, and hopefully, still a little geology and paleontology into their world and have a broader appreciation for the columns and for the landscape around us. So, sure, yeah, there are fossils everywhere around here, and we're going to try to take advantage of that.
That was paleobiology professor John Huntley. Jungha Brookshire is a professor of textile apparel management. Intersection producer Abby Ivory Ganya sat down with Ha Brookshire in her office to talk about her wide-ranging career.
I did my undergraduate at Seoul National University in South Korea. After I submit my final exam, I just packed them up and flew out to New York City with $3,000 in 2 suitcases. And not knowing what's going to happen, I started, I just wanted to explore my life in the world. And that happens to be in New York City. So I worked there for fashion companies for 8.5 years or so. I traveled all over the world looking for the apparel factories, fabric suppliers, accessory suppliers. I made a negotiation. We placed an order, we made the clothing over there and bring them back here. And then we distributed products to the major retailers. And I did that for about 8.5 years. And then I realized that, ooh, I missed my school. So I quit and I moved down to North Carolina, got my PhD. And now I'm here. This is my 11th year as a professor. And I teach global sourcing, and I also teach senior capstone class for retail marketing merchandising students. Because I've been in the industry for long and I know understand the dynamics of the industry, so I try to match my students' talents to fit into the right sector of the industry, because this industry is so big and huge and global.
Can you give me an example of what that's like? With maybe walk me through what the capstone was like for a specific student and how you worked with their talents.
So all of the textile apparel management students, especially who are seeking the retail marketing and merchandising track degree, they have to take the capstone in their usually in their final semester. A few of them take it in the winter before the semester. But anyway, so they have taken all this curriculum, so they know the basics of the everything. Now it's time when they have to pull all the knowledge that they learned so far, pull all the knowledge together, create a new business plan to solve any sort of a problems that today's consumer market faces. So like this semester, we realized that there is a lot of online fashion consumers are having trouble with incorrect representation of colors or wrong sizes or whatever. So there is a lot of return is happening in fashion online market. So I gave this challenge to students, and this is you as a group have to solve it. And so come up with a new way of addressing these problems. So that's the semester-long project. Each group, man, it's difficult. Up and downs, because nobody can do this for 4 months, I mean, with groups, and that's hard. But while they are going through that project, but I also, at least 1 hour a week, we talk about career planning, leadership, and through that discussion, I also try to help students to find their true strength. Because not everyone is good at everything. And so don't just dwell on your weakness, Rather, now that you know your weakness, you now know who to collaborate with, because you want somebody who's better at certain things that you're not good at. And that, and meantime, that person may think that you are amazing at talent B. So, you know, just finding the right match, finding the right company where my strength can flourish. Meantime, I could also respect and learn and other people's strength. So this is why you and I are collaborating and working together.
The other thing I've heard about you from students is that you do these experiential learning tours. Can you give me a little information about that?
So I realized that the more I teach, and I realized that students have a very narrow view about the industry. What would be the best way to, I mean, I can preach it all day long in the classroom, but what would be the best way for them to actually see and see the opportunity? So I started taking students to New York. I lived in New York, so I know the city very well. I know the companies well. And now over the years, I have so many students who are now living in working in New York City, and they are opening up their companies. They get to see variety of the jobs and opportunity within the fashion industry, from art suppliers, you know, somebody who does nothing but graphic art fabric design all day long, to all the way to visual merchandising and sourcing, you know, fashion forecasting, fabric development, you know, their development and pattern making and product development and also digital marketing nowadays.
Can you tell me a little bit about your research? Because what I saw, the topics that you dealt with were kind of about the moral responsibility of companies. I'd love to hear what you found.
Yeah, so, you know, 2 years ago, I published this new theory. It's called a moral responsibility theory of corporate sustainability. What it means is that sustainability is not something that you can do at the end. You know, when everything is done, I'm going to just add a little bit of sprinkle. So I'm going to make it a sustainable product. No, it's that sustainability is the fundamental duty for any companies to fulfill. I borrowed this concept, it's called corporate personhood. In the US law, the company is considered a person. So now, as a company, they can even make a donation to political campaigns, right? So then, if company has a personal will to like endorse, you know, certain political campaign, then company should also have a will to be sustainable. That means you can't just, you know, make your money by hurting others, by devastating environments, by demolishing a community. You see, nobody does it. We as a person, we don't do that. And it is one of the fundamental duty to protect the environment, to enhance society and community while you're making money as a social member. Our students are going out and say, companies, we can't just make money and close our eyes. We need to do it right. We need to do the right thing.
The trips, your research, the capstone course, you know, seems to be paying off because you are a 2017 Kemper Fellow,
yes,
which honors outstanding teachers here at the university. What was receiving that award like?
Oh, no. I felt like, whew, I made the right decision. Because when I quit my job in New York, right, in 10 years ago, 13 years ago already, I could have stayed there and I could have moved up the chain however I saw in the industry. And when I quit and suddenly became a grad student thinking that I may have another future in my career, I mean, I knew I could do it. I hoped it was the right decision. Of course, I was honored and all, but it was also, you know, assured that I am on the right path. I have another next 20 more years of teaching, and that's a good feeling, that, you know, the validation. So I appreciated that.
That was Jung Ha Brookshire, a professor of textile apparel management. Dr. Tim Evans solves mysteries involving animals. Evans is a professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine and works in the school's medical diagnostic laboratory.
I do a lot of evaluation of the results from the laboratory and then interpretation of those results and then consulting with the veterinarians. And occasionally, I'll go out when the test results don't make sense with with what's happened with the animals, I'll go out and do a field visit and walk through a field or look at the animals. Oftentimes I have a specific thing I'm looking for, a specific plant. You know, one of the things is that a lot of people aren't aware is that CCA-treated lumber, which was extremely common, but it contains chromium, copper, and arsenic. And when you burn that lumber, the arsenic in particular becomes available to the animals. And I've had a number of cases over the last year where somebody has burned a chute or fence material or something, cattle have gotten into it, and it's very, very deadly. And so I've had a number of cases where I've gone out to identify if there's a burn pile. It's amazing. You ask somebody, do you have a junk pile? No, I don't have a junk pile. Well, then I go out and I see a burn pile and I see a pile of what I would consider to be junk, but I guess if it's on your property for 10 years and nothing bad happens, it's not really a junk pile. It's just some type of monument or
extra stuff.
Extra stuff. That's just where we put the extra stuff.
Yeah.
But it's amazing how you can run into those types of situations.
And so people are burning this wood that's been treated, and then the cows are eating around it
It's kind of salty. Mm. And so apparently the cattle will go out and eat it. One thing I will admit to, I've not been able to read the bovine mind yet. I'm not a cow whisperer, but in some situations, and oftentimes it has to do with perhaps the level of the quality of hay is not as good as it was earlier in the year, or there's not other things for them to eat, or hey, you're a cow, you're bored. Okay, hey, this looks pretty exciting, that kind of thing.
And so that sounds like you had to sort of be a detective and figure this out on different farms where you were seeing these problems with cows. Are there other situations where you've had to go out and figure out what's going on the ground to understand toxins?
What happens is when these cases aren't making sense is that something gets left out, something that someone doesn't think is particularly an important fact. The fact that, hey, there are junk piles, there's a burn pile, there is this plant growing in this particular pasture. We had a situation just a week ago where, the owner had some animals. Some of them showed that they were lame. Some of them that they were having difficulty walking, a couple of animals. But then a lot of the animals had a difficulty in breathing. They were breathing rapidly. They had high temperatures. But the animal that we got down here that was lame, what we ended up finding on the post-mortem examination, there was actually a fracture and trauma to one of the legs, didn't necessarily fit with what was going on with the breathing. So we went up to the farm and we found that there's a common plant in Missouri called Perilla mint. And again, it grows in a lot of pastures, so don't necessarily eat it, but it was hot in this pasture. There was a lot of other kinds of invasive species of plants. There wasn't a lot of good pasture grass. It had been really dry and hot in this particular part of the state. And underneath the trees, where it was cool, that's what was growing. So that made perfect sense. And so that was a really good experience. I had a pathology resident, a couple of interns from the hospital. We had eight veterinary professional students. I mean, it was originally started out as, hey, I was just going to go check this out, and then it became a small army. But it was a great experience for the students. I mean, they got to see it, and many people think I just sit in my office and just talk all day. So they actually saw that I can walk, I can actually look at things, communicate with the clients, communicate with the referring veterinarian. And again, I think that's a huge, huge part of how the University of Missouri works for Missouri is communicating. But again, showing the fact of that you can go ahead and think about things, communicate to people, go ahead and talk in a language that they understand. And oftentimes in the cases that I'm investigating, I kind of use I call it the Mona Lisa principle, okay? I don't ever get the whole puzzle. I mean, I get little pieces of the puzzle. And as the pieces come together, if I can go ahead and get enough information that I can make out that it's the Mona Lisa, then that's great. I might be missing, one eye and an eyebrow, and I may not have her complete outfit, but I can tell it's her. Always, oftentimes in an academic environment, sometimes we want all the pieces and we want everything to make sense. But in the real world, rarely do we have all the pieces. But if I have enough to go ahead and say that's what it is, then that's satisfactory for our referring veterinarians, for our clients, to have an understanding of what is going on.
Yes, and it sounds like your work has just so many practical applications. I mean, it's very practical, even though it is academic in its nature as well. Speaking of teaching, you do this project where vet students are presented with a variety of household items that are also toxins.
Yeah.
And so they pick their poison. Can you tell me about that project?
Yeah. The thing that's really important in teaching is making it something that's relevant, that they can understand why it's important, and also do something that they can say, hey, oh, I learned something. And so it's the dose or the dosage, the amount of which an individual is exposed, that's going to determine whether you're going to have a toxic effect or a beneficial effect. So what I do, I buy a bunch of things just right off the shelves. I mean, everything from underarm deodorant to Red Bull to something from automotive, lots of different things. And so the students get a chance at the beginning of their pathology block. They get a chance to go ahead and reach in. They get to pick two things. One of the purposes of this project is, okay, somebody, one of your clients, their dog or their cat has eaten this product. How do you figure out whether that's going to be potentially toxic?
How do you research? How do you drill down on
it? Yeah, how do you go ahead and what information do you have access? What are some general rules of thumb that help you so that when your client calls you, rather than just say, well, I don't know, you've actually got some basic information that you can communicate with the client, comes down to communication, and give them some information that comforts them or gives them enough concern of what we need to do.
I mean, I assume that the recommendation for people when their cat or dog consumes something and they're not sure about it is to call their veterinarian and see what's going on.
Yeah.
But are there things that you, like, what's the most common thing that dogs get into that gets them in trouble?
Oh, I think in the list of the big things, and increasing, there's an increasing amount of small animals, particularly small companion animals, getting into human medications. That immediately is call your veterinarian and mostly get your dog to be examined by a veterinary professional.
That was Tim Evans of the College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you for joining us here on Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. And of course, thank you to our guests, MU professors John Huntley, Jung-Ha Brookshire, and Tim Evans. If you'd like to listen to this show again, visit us online at kbia.org. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where we are at IntersectKBIA. Our producers are Abby Ivory Gagne, Elena Rivera, and Hannah Haynes. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.